It's very clear that if you want to penetrate the establishment, the easiest way to do it is through royal families often, because there's so little scrutiny of them. Andrew and Sarah Ferguson were under surveillance by MI6, and they were warned countless times about their associates, told to cut loose. They didn't.
Like, to be honest, like, if you're not in those files, it would be an insult, because it just means that you were a bit of a loser.
I've been working with FBI documents, for example, and reports to the FBI for about 40 years. I use them extensively.
The whole Epstein files, as they're coming out, are showing the extent of connections between Epstein and Russia.
Well, I think the relationship with Mossad doesn't preclude one with the KGB. These things are not, you just pick one football team. There's a lot of information being traded, and my enemy's enemy can be my friend.
You said on Talk TV that you'd received a death threat.
The other researchers in this area have actually been murdered.
The latest revelations from the Epstein files raised some serious questions about the reliability of what the then Prince Andrew said in a BBC Newsnight interview.
I don't think he will ever go to prison, because he will just escape to the Middle East before charges can be brought. I mean, I think he's a flight risk myself. This is a crisis for democracy at the moment. This is where maybe the role of the monarchy, holding the nation together, leading by example, would help. And the problem is they're not leading by example. They're some of the worst offenders.
What's left? New episode on the Epstein files. Today we're joined by Andrew Launey, one of the world's leading experts on the royal family. In fact, Andrew recently has published a book called entitled The Rise and Fall of the House of York, detailing the awful stories that we've all been seeing in the press recently about Prince Andrew and his relationship with the disgraced financier, paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Andrew, you've been all over the press recently. But I actually want to backtrack a little bit, because as I understand it, your reputation as a historian took a bit of a beating coming into revealing what's happened with Prince Andrew and the story about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein.
Yes, it did. I mean, I've been writing books for over 40 years. I mean, I was a fellow of the Royal Historical Society and a former fellow of a Cambridge college. And so it was, I think I've shown with all the books I've done, which have always been immaculately sourced, that, you know, I am a serious historian. But when this book came out, entitled The Rise and Fall of the House of York, people didn't want to believe it, even though, again, everything is sourced. It went through all legals. We've never had any problems by it. But a lot of the mainstream press didn't touch it. I had the same problem with the book on Traitor King, my previous book on Edward VIII. And then gradually people do come through, and I think they've now, I feel vindicated by the release of these Epstein documents. It's backed up everything I had. All the stuff I had, for example, on Mandelson was taken out because the publishers didn't believe it. And so I think we're going to be able to put a lot more stuff back in. One of my sources, which again the publishers didn't think was reliable, has proved to be absolutely accurate on a lot of these stories. And I think the really interesting thing about the release is it's part of a situation that's been going for a while, and it's what sort of Trump kind of was elected off the back of, which was to sort of drain the swamp in Washington of these elites who operate only in their own self-interest. Now, you could argue that Trump operates in exactly the same way, as also a consummate insider. But I think the big change now is we have social media, and social media has driven this story. In the past, the mainstream press could be controlled through access, through pressure. But this is more difficult now, and particularly with citizen journalists and things done on social media. I found, for example, I get lots of tips through social media now, or the comments are below articles. So that's a whole new source of material that I didn't have even a couple of years ago. And people want these people held to account and feel they have some influence. And we've seen that, not least in the kind of change of tone in government and indeed the media. After my book came out, I felt that the press was slightly more emboldened in how they reported the royals, much less deferential. I mean, the two important leaks of emails by the Mail on Sunday, which showed that both Sarah Ferguson and Andrew had had longer associations and later associations with Epstein than they had admitted. And that kind of softened the earth. And then it had a sort of snowball effect. And I think we've got to the stage where, you know, the king is being heckled.
Joe, how long have you known about Andrew and Epstein?
People are not satisfied by what he's done. And the little people are beginning to speak against the elites. But I think, again, what this release has shown is just how extensive the tentacles are with world leaders in the States, in Europe, in the Middle East, and elsewhere, who are sort of clearly compromisers. Other members of the royal family also, other royal families. And I think what shocks me is just how easily these people can be bought. Mandelson taking £10,000 because he couldn't, as a multimillionaire, afford to pay for his boyfriend's course. I think, you know, it's very clear that if you want to penetrate the establishment, the easiest way to do it is through royal families often, because there is so little scrutiny of them. And often they are very greedy and very immoral. And I think this is why it's so important that we do have proper scrutiny and transparency. It's something I've been calling for over a decade. I was a lone voice, seen as a very, very much an outlier and a sort of anti-establishment figure. But it's all just about integrity in public life and being able to trust institutions. And I think the problem we've got now is so many of our institutions, whether the judiciary, the foreign office, the intelligence services, the police, the parliament, the monarchy, the public are losing trust and respect for them because they feel they've abused their positions of privilege.
I think that idea about the psychology of the elites, you know, in this kind of watershed moment where trust in institutions is completely fraying, where people don't feel like, you know, the story that they're being told in the mainstream media is one that's true. I mean, it's part of the reason why I set up a podcast was because I can see that people need trusted sources for information, and they need people to feel like when they're hearing stuff about ideas that are happening in the press, that the person who's researching them, you know, I need to know what their biases are, because of course they're going to have biases. You know, I think we sometimes pretend, don't we, that someone can be perfectly objective in the way that they're retelling the story, but the truth is, you know, I run a progressive political podcast, I have left-wing tendencies. It might mean that some ideas that I'm more interested than others, and some, you know, there's some threads that I'll pull on, you know, with greater vigor than looking into others. I mean, that's just natural by being a human being. But if we really dig deep now into what has happened with these latest tranche of emails, we've seen, you know, that photo, that really shocking photo of Andrew on all fours over a woman. She looks like potentially a younger woman. It's hard to tell for certain because of it being redacted. But we've also seen some really, you know, shocking claims. I saw an infographic on Instagram by a really large profile called UK Fact Check Politics. I don't know if you've come across this. It's an email suggesting that Andrew was involved with the death of two girls. Now, I don't know if this email is legitimate or not. It's apparently been released in the tranche that have come out. But, I mean, is that something that you'd ever heard of? Like, these are really serious claims that are in these emails. And, of course, the fact that there's an email doesn't mean that it's happened. I'm not accusing them that it's happened. But it's really shocking, isn't it, to be seeing this information and not really being able to tell what is true and what is false.
Yes, I mean, some of the stuff that's appearing is very dark. And I say it's almost like Eyes Wide Shut meets the Yes Minister plus the Crown. I've seen those stories. I mean, I've been working with FBI documents, for example, and reports to the FBI for about 40 years. I use them extensively. But of course, you have to treat them with caution. Just because there's a report doesn't mean it's true. It often gives you leads and you can check them to see if you can verify it. I think important thing is to see what happened next. Did the FBI dismiss it? Did they investigate it? What were the reports saying, etc.? But yes, there are stories. There's a story in Surrey of sort of satanic rites and young girls dying. And it's interesting that the FBI have been approached, I think, by the Surrey police for more information. I think there's also stories of young woman dying in rough sex and being buried on a golf course in the States. And to be honest, you know, having done these books now, nothing really surprises me. I think I'm skeptical. I'm trained as a historian with my doctorate to question the evidence. But, you know, sometimes this stuff, you know, the truth is stranger than fiction. You know, I think we've only had the 3 million pages, only 3 million. The 3 million pages that have been kept back, because they're seen to be the sensitive ones. So it'll be interesting to see if those are released, and that should be the campaign now. I don't think anything should be kept back. I mean, many of the victims have already been identified or identified themselves. I don't think that's an excuse that can be used, because I think people do feel that we do need for the full story to be told. And we're going to see a number of people toppling. You're absolutely right. I mean, I've always been fascinated by the way that networks and the establishment works. my books have often been about figures who seem consummate insiders, but actually felt they were outside the establishment, from the writer John Buchan through to the spy Guy Burgess. But I've sort of ended up writing about royal biography, partly because so few other people do in a serious way, but also because it is so fascinating, because it's about the curation of our history. What we think is true isn't necessarily true, because so many documents are not released, are often destroyed or heavily redacted. And because there's a murder around often members of the elite, particularly the royal family, and they have powers of patronage or pressure, often we don't get the oral history either. And I think that's what fascinates me and worries me, that the history that we think we have is not really our true history.
And you brought up the case of Guy Burgess there. I believe he's one of the Cambridge Five, one of the Russian agents who was embedded in the British establishment. I understand it's your belief that Epstein was able to get away with as much as he was because he could have been a Russian agent. I really want to interrogate this idea a bit more, because, of course, the sleuths on the internet have been long kind of looking into whether Epstein was working in kind of compromat for the KGB or perhaps even for Mossad, for the Israelis. You know, in these latest emails, one figure who comes up over and over again is Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister. He has a clearly strong friendship and trusted relationship with Epstein. And in fact, in those emails with Ehud Barak, there are mentions of Putin and of Russia. There's also, of course, the long-established relationship between Robert Maxwell, the father of Ghislaine Maxwell, the only person to be convicted and, you know, serving any jail time for the whole Epstein affair. Robert Maxwell, I believe, had three different heads of Mossad at his funeral, which is to say that they obviously thought that he'd played an integral part in supporting their services. I believe that was one of the things that was said at his funeral. I mean, why are you leaning more towards this Russia angle? You know, a lot of people on the left, you know, for various reasons, I assume, are more interested into perhaps Epstein's relationship with Israel and Mossad.
Well, I think the relationship with Mossad doesn't preclude one with the KGB. I mean, you've mentioned Robert Maxwell. He was a sort of mentor of Epstein. There's suggestions that Epstein was basically hiding the Mirror pension money. You're absolutely right. Maxwell, was buried on the Mount of Olives. I mean, had strong connections with Israeli intelligence, but also worked for Russian intelligence. Indeed, he worked for British intelligence. I mean, these things are not, you just pick one football team. There's a lot of information being traded, and my enemy's enemy can be my friend. And that was the case with Epstein. Epstein traded information. He was tasked by different agencies. It's now very clear he was a Russian asset. I have seen documents, intelligence documents, showing that. And that would make sense. He was involved in some of the money laundering of Russian money into the States, money, something that Trump was also involved in. You've got to remember also, these releases are showing that many in Trump's inner circle were deeply involved with Epstein, partly sexually and partly financially. Trump keeps being roped back into the story. But, you know, I can only follow the evidence, and the evidence shows that Epstein was a Russian asset. He was collecting compromat. In the book, I quote a man called Tim Riley, who's a Cambridge academic, about the compromat that Putin had on Andrew. We know that he got this material from Mark Dugan, from the raids in Palm Beach, the videos of that were taken for compromat, and some of that stuff's ended up with Putin. So I don't think there's any doubt about the Russian links, and I don't think there's any doubt about the Mossad links either. I mean, one of the interesting things is Barak, we have to be careful what we say here, but appears quite extensively, both on national, on sexual grounds, shall we say, in the files. So it may well be that there were a whole level of relationships going on, and a whole different series of pressures being put on people.
And if we return to Prince Andrew, do you think he was aware that Epstein was involved with the security services of ostensibly many countries, Or do you think that he was kept away from that information about how intricately involved Epstein was with these different security services?
Oh, I'm sure he knew. He was told. I mean, Andrew and Sarah Ferguson were under surveillance by MI6, and they were warned countless times about their associates, told to cut loose. They didn't. And that's why some of these stories are now emerging, and the intelligence services are briefing to get their version of events out. But I don't think he had any doubt. I don't think he cared. He was driven by what Epstein could provide for him, which were useful contacts, paying Fergie's debts, and a ready supply of women.
And Andrew, you have been involved in this story since the very beginning, and I understand that that's not been very straightforward. I mean, recently you said on Talk TV that you'd received a death threat. I kind of wonder, who are the people who are trying to silence you when it comes to talking about this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've reported these things to the police. They may be monarchists, they may be nutters, who knows? I am aware that other researchers in this area have actually been murdered. Daphne Galizia, the Maltese journalist who was blown up, was investigating some of the rings that I'm looking at myself in my investigations. I mean, one's dealing with some serious criminal activity here. And Russian intelligence, and neither of them have any compunction about sticking a syringe in your leg and giving you a heart attack.
But how does that make you feel? I mean, you're putting your life on the line potentially.
You know, I mean, you know, if someone wants to kill me, they can kill me. You know, there are lots of ways of doing it. You can't operate your life on that basis or stop talking out. I feel very strongly that these are issues that need to be aired, that we need to bring integrity back into public life, that people in positions of privilege and responsibility need to act properly and need to be held to account and, if necessary, face justice, that we don't have a two-tier justice system here, that everyone is equal under the law. And that's why I think Andrew should be investigated and, if necessary, charged, and exactly the same with Peter Mandelson.
And I imagine you would have felt that way if Andrew was still a royal and hadn't lost his titles. I believe it's under our current, we don't really have a constitution, but our current legal practices that the king, for instance, couldn't be tried by the laws in our own country because he is the head of state and that the royal family are above the rule of law. I mean, that feels, that kind of idea of us being citizens of a second class, whilst this other, you know, family gets to do as they please, feels like it's from a completely archaic time and something that cannot be justified today.
Well, I agree. And I think things are changing. I mean, under Erskine May, parliamentarians were not allowed to ask any questions about the royal family. It was felt very important that crown and state should be kept separate. I think that's changing. We've got the Parliament, the Public Accounts Committee now looking at Crown Estate leases. We've got the Speaker of the House of Commons, Hoyle, saying that actually Andrew, whether he's a civilian or a member of the royal family, you know, should be investigated. We've got Keir Starmer saying that Andrew should give testimony to the Senate. In the past, politicians would never tell royals what they should be doing. And this is right. And this is why Andrew was seen as such an easy way into to what Epstein wanted, the influence he wanted to exert. And if you've got nothing to hide, you should have no concerns about some scrutiny. You know, it's ridiculous that royal wills are still closed, that they have these exemptions under the Freedom of Information Act, that there isn't a proper royal register, that their finances are so opaque. That they don't pay capital gains and inheritance tax. We don't even know what necessarily they pay in income tax. You know, all these things, if you're going to be in a modern democracy, need to change. And this is an opportunity for them to make themselves fit for purpose. And I think the big question is, are they going to realise that and realise in order to maintain the trust and respect of the British people, they need to do it? Or are they going to continue down their secretive ways with offshore accounts and secretive trusts?
So it's my understanding then for you as a monarchist that you don't think this is necessarily the end for the royal family.
Well, I hope it's not the end for the royal family because I do think it's our least worst option. I do think they do a great deal of good work. We have their soft power. We have the fact that they unite the nation. I think some of the alternatives are not, to my mind, better. But, you know, clearly, if it's demonstrated that Andrew and Sarah Ferguson are not just loose rogue royals, bad apples, that actually this cynicism and corruption pervades the whole family, going right up to the monarch. And the monarch has, for example, with Queen Elizabeth, protected and Andrew and covered up this behavior, then I think public attitudes will change and they will lose a lot of their support. We can't really get rid of the monarchy, but they can become less less important. We've seen actually interesting changes in Spain, where King Juan Carlos of Spain was very much involved in corruption in Kazakhstan. That he actually was up on corruption charges. He actually had to flee to Dubai, but King Felipe was very firm about distancing himself. We see the situation with the Crown Princess of Norway and her son up for on trial for rape and drugs, and they are taking that seriously. They are briefing the press. They are kind of facing up to it. And then we have here the Brits who are just hoping the problem will go away and sticking their head in the sand.
There are some monarchist historians, and I'm sure you're aware of this, who argue that a parliamentary democracy in hand with a monarchist regime or monarchist history has actually proven quite robust in the face of kind of democratic evolution over the last 300-400 years. For the UK, we managed to avoid something like that, what happened in France with the French Revolution. And it feels to me, though, that one of the kind of big examples or one of the big symptoms of a society that starts to fray at the seams and to disintegrate is an elite class who just don't understand where the rest of the population is at. And that when you take that in tandem with, you know, an economic crisis or perhaps crises in sequence, you get a very febrile environment, that one that is often conducive to quite serious systemic political change. I'm often reminded of a book by the academic Peter Turchin. I don't know if you've come across his work. It's called End Times. And what Turchin does is he looks at different societies over history and he tries to understand what about them leads to their disintegration. And one of the kind of main products of Turchin's analysis is that you get elite overproduction, that when societies become richer, you know, all of the new GDP growth that happens, it gets recycled back into the top 1%. And then you get too many elites, and the elites start duking it out over the kind of same amount of jobs. There's only one prime minister, there's only one president, there's only one head of a law firm, etc. The reason I bring this up is just because Epstein was so, you know, infiltrated in all of these different royal families across the world. It wasn't just the UK. It wasn't just the elite, you know, in the transatlantic relationship. It was all over Europe and beyond. It was in the Middle East as well with the royal families there. It feels to me that with the scrutiny of social media, with the inability of those in power to just control the narrative, that things can leak out. As you can say, historians and journalists can get leads just by scrolling on Twitter. That they aren't in a position to make us believe, us normal people, that they aren't in charge.
You know? Yeah, I agree entirely with that. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I agree. And this is driven by social media. And I mean, you know exactly what happened in Russia when we had a possible tipping point in Iran, but clearly, you know, the control of the intelligence agencies remained, which is often another aspect to this. But I agree. And I mean, it's what a lot of people voted for Trump. And I think there is a possible tipping point here, you know, when you get concerns about a whole range of things, whether it's immigration or the economy, or this sense that government isn't working in your favor, but in their own self-interest. And I think this is why the elites need to look at these issues and need to be very careful. And we need, and this is why transparency and accountability are so important, because that is the way, this is one of the checks and balances. If people feel they're under scrutiny, then they tend to behave better.
And do you think that it's likely that we'll see some level of accountability with Andrew? Do you think he could be facing criminal proceedings at some point? Is that the type of thing that you
would
expect?
Yeah, well, I think he should be investigated. I think he should be charged. Whether it will go that way, I mean, the Met and of others have constantly found ways to dodge that. I don't think he will ever go to prison, because he will just escape to the Middle East before charges can be brought. I mean, I think he's a flight risk myself, but at the moment, no charges have been brought, so you can't do anything. And that's how it is. The royal family will not want their dirty linen washed in public. We know that from the Burrell trial a few years ago. So there will be some British compromise here in which they'll go through the motions. They may then issue an arrest warrant and then find that he's disappeared.
reports in the press suggest that Andrew isn't very contrite, or perhaps he doesn't quite understand the gravity of what's happening right now. I believe he was photographed the other day on a horse, just galloping around, frolicking about. Surely anyone can understand in this situation how serious and grave these accusations are.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is why the king needs to step in, I mean, and not leave Andrew to kind of drive the narrative. I know from a fact, for talking to a member of staff in the last week, that he is not contrite or has no remorse. He can't understand what the fuss is. He feels he's a victim. He's innocent. And this is because he's a narcissist. He cannot accept a situation which doesn't kind of shape the narrative. He has no empathy with other people, which is very clear from his dealings with people. And so it's very difficult to get that message across. It's all about his own self-interests. And I would argue that Epstein was probably a narcissist, so was Sarah Ferguson. So it was a very potent mix. But it is extraordinary. And this is why the royal family need to kind of compensate for that. They need to go beyond just saying we're thinking of the victims. They need to show that they are really going to punish him. But moving to a 5-bedroom house and ostensibly not being able to call yourself Duke of York is not a huge punishment.
And what do you think made Andrew a narcissist? I mean, there's many kind of cases of within psychology that experiences that a young child can have quite a strong bearing on why people turn out later in adult life to be someone who doesn't have any empathy, for instance. I believe Simon Baron Cohen, the psychologist, has a study which looks at 0 degrees of empathy, and he looks at narcissists alongside borderline personality disorder alongside psychopaths, and say all of these people have it in common. They literally cannot see what life could be like in someone else's shoes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, interestingly, wearing my literary agent hat, I did a book with someone called Daniel Tammet, who's got autism. And he said that he had this problem. But he learnt, you know, for example, a sense of humour was something he couldn't understand, but he learnt from other people's behaviour how to conform and how to fit into this. So, but I think Andrew was spoilt as a child. He was given no boundaries. No one was allowed to discipline him all the way through school and the Navy and everything. There were sycophants around him telling him how wonderful he was and indulging him, letting him do exactly what he wanted. And because he's not very bright and because he's greedy and because he knew he could get away with it and he's a sex addict, he kind of took advantage of this. You know, if you're stuck in the sweetie shop and the lids are unscrewed, you're going to taste the sweeties.
And I believe on that sex addiction or hypersexuality point, you found a story about Andrew as a child. Could you expand a little bit more on that?
Yes, it's a story that I found hard to believe, and I wasn't going to put it in, but I floated it, and actually several people have come forward to confirm it. It's the story that a father of one of his school friends, when he was 11, took him to a brothel to engage with a prostitute. And other people from Heather Down have said that doesn't surprise them. Other people have had similar experiences, remarkable as it seems. And this would perhaps explain, you know, his inability to form relationships with women, his constant need for, I mean, for example, I have a story of 40 prostitutes in 4 days in Thailand. That would explain the very transactional nature of sex. Same with Epstein as well. I mean, Epstein had to have his massages each day. And it makes it's not just a story about I suppose, finances and national security. It's also a sort of psychosexual drama, this. We had extraordinary circumstances where Ghislaine was sleeping with Andrew and with Epstein, with Sarah. Sarah Ferguson was sleeping with Epstein as one of her mentors, as well as with Andrew. So they're all kind of connected in this sort of bit like a dance to the music of time.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a drama from like ancient civilization, as if from like Roman times. I mean, are we just repeating the same cycles over again with these elites who could do whatever they will?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that when elites don't have any form of control, they end up doing the same things, abusing their power and chasing the other sex. And I suppose, you know, that I know from intelligence that, you know, there are 4 things that are used to recruit agents, what's called mice. So money, ideology, compromise and ego. And sex comes into a lot of these.
And now when you think about what could happen next for Andrew, you said that you think he's a flight risk. Can you explain why he could possibly end up in the Middle East and why they would even want to shelter him? Surely that would be a bad look for any of the oligarchs there.
Well, I think the great thing is they don't have a free press, so no one would know he was there. There certainly wouldn't be the scrutiny he's getting now. He's very, very friendly with several of the rulers there, who treat him as a son. They've offered him palaces and accommodation. It's, as I say, where King Juan Carlos went. They couldn't care about their reputations. I mean, if you've got a reputation for cutting up journalists, having Prince Andrew there isn't going to change things much. So I don't think they could care. He's useful. He's got a lot of business interests there, particularly in Bahrain. And he will be seen as very much one of them. It's a very corrupt countries which believe very strongly in hierarchy, which is exactly what he believes in.
How much do you think, Andrew, that this is a consequence of an increasingly kind of globalized and financialized economy that, you know, in the reduction of friction with the ability for money just to transfer over the world in seconds, the system seems even more ripe for abuse, for corruption? And when you kind of look at essentially what Epstein was dealing in, how he managed his power, how he managed his relationships, it all seemed to be from the fact that money was being generated at such a rapid pace that all you needed to do was shoot off a few emails here and there and you could have a slice of the pie.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he was involved in the subprime mortgage things. I mean, they were manipulating markets. And I think that's what's so extraordinary, that a few powerful figures, particularly with insider information, and this is why the Mandelson is so serious, but the markets can be manipulated, politicians can be manipulated, even the electorate can be manipulated. This is what is so frightening. I mean, the control people have over our lives, when we think that we live in a democracy and we're all equal under the law and we can all got an equal vote, we find that some are more equal than others. You know, good old George Orwell again. So it is part of the modern global economy. And the fact that all these people knew each other, just a few key people in a few key networks could have such powerful influence, I think is very frightening, with very few checks and balances and so easily compromised.
Do you think part of the reason why it went so long for this to be uncovered, in a similar way to the actual grooming gang story in the UK, it's often spoken about of, you know, there were groups of men, some of Pakistani heritage in the UK who were abusing young women in parts of the UK, but sometimes it was Tories were in charge or sometimes it was Labour who was in charge, that so many members of the political class were implicated in this scandal that no one really wanted to talk about it. It kind of feels like it has the same ring of it now with the Epstein scandal in particular. For instance, you know, Reform UK have not been one to shirk the opportunity to talk about grooming gangs and people being implicated, but they've been quite quiet, I think, in relative to kind of other stories that they focus on when it comes to the Epstein scandal. I believe actually some emails might even involve Nick Candy, the current Reform Treasurer. I don't know if you've come across those.
Yep.
Do you think that that's part of the reason that we see less salience on this story? I mean, it's definitely been different with this latest release of the emails, but broadly speaking, over the last 6 years, all of this stuff has been in plain sight.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and I think it's only, perhaps seeing the scale of it. I mean, I think, you know, I've been writing about the stuff other people have been writing about, Oliver Bullock and Tom Burgess and others. But I think it's just hit a nerve because I think it's got that all the ingredients for a good story for the press. It's got sex, it's got famous people, royalty, corruption, national security. And I think that's kind of given it a sort of, I wouldn't say humanized it, but it's sort of personalized it and people can identify that. I mean, people have known about, you know, this sort of stuff and how people buy up companies and assets strip them and, you know, don't pay their shareholders dividends and run things down and all this sort of stuff. But I think it's when you see it around particular individuals and particularly pretty odious individuals like Andrew, it's very easy to see the sort of the enemy the adversary here. But, you know, I think what always intrigues me is, you know, these people started off, a bit like Paradise Lost, you know, they weren't corrupted. And it's only because of power, an absolute power and the lack of proper checks and balances that they would be able to go down the route they did. I mean, we all know immoral people that we've grown up with and we knew that they were going to end up as doing dodgy things. But I think what's sad is to see people who I've respected and known and I think had all the right instincts corrupted by either their reluctance to speak out because of the penalties that they might have and a lack of moral courage, or else are just very happy to stick their nose in the trough and join everyone else.
It reminds me of a thing that John Gray said when he was asked about whether he predicted the end of the Soviet Union. And he said that he did see it coming, but not for the reasons that most people presume. What he said was that there was a hollowness at the centre of Soviet society, that even people at the bottom end of it knew that there wasn't really any kind of guiding light or truth to the story that they were being told in the mainstream about their ideology and what had legitimised the regime. I worry, actually, now that we're living in the kind of similar moment, people talk kind of openly that we're living in revolutionary times, that things are about to change in a very drastic, systemic way. And that there feels like there's a bit of a hollowness, you know, that we don't really believe in the legitimacy of our system, that the people at the top don't play by the same rules as everyone else. And if that's the case, then why should any of us, you know, abide by the rules? That seems like a recipe for disaster. You know, if you read any history about what happens when things go bad in societies, it's messy for everyone, you know, not just for, you know, people at the bottom, including for the elites as well. If you were living in Paris under Robespierre, you know, it was not a good time for them. I just wonder what you think we can do when it comes to institutional trust. How do we repair it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, my first book was a biography of John Buchan, and John Buchan talks about the thin line of civilization and how it's a thin shard of glass, and it can change in a minute. And all these outwardly respectable people, members of smart London clubs, can turn out to be, you know, working for foreign powers or crooks. And so it's always sort of been there. How do we change it? Well, I think it's join the campaign for freedom of information. I think the more members there who are lobbying for accountability and transparency, whether it's for in historical documents or it's in procurement now, anything which makes people have scrutiny, I think makes them behave better. And that's what we need. And then we just set an example. And at the top, the leadership comes from the top. And so if we have politicians who tell lies and other people feel it's okay to tell lies, if we don't even deal with quite minor crimes, like, for example, shoplifting, then people feel emboldened to commit crime, but also feel that the state isn't protecting them and will take the law into their own hands. And I think we have, you know, we are on the pivotal point there. You know, we have groups in Essex who complain about immigrants coming in. It's a problem both from the left and the right. And people are increasingly looking for extremist solutions rather than the trust in the centre ground. And that is where very worrying, that, you know, it is the extremists who seem to be calling the shots. And we've seen the hollowing out, for example, of the Tory party. There are lots and lots of former Tory supporters who feel that they have nowhere to go. I suspect that may be true of a lot of Labour supporters, too, that the things that they felt were important about the Labour Party in the past are no longer represented. So this is a crisis for democracy at the moment. And this is where maybe the role of the monarchy holding the nation together, leading by example, would help. And the problem is they're not leading by example. They're some of the worst offenders.
I wonder whether any of this has changed your politics at all personally, like, you know, just the experience of reading and learning and you know, putting your neck on the line, your reputation as well, to stand up these claims. You know, how's that journey been personally for you? Has it changed any of your beliefs, any of your ultimate axioms that you hold yourself by?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm less trusting of institutions and of elites. I mean, I was a parliamentary journalist at one point. I was a Conservative parliamentary candidate as a sort of one nation Tory. And I sort of joke that I've moved more to the left. I mean, I don't think I've changed. I think politics has changed, but that's what everyone says. But the things, you know, the old and maybe rather paternalistic approach, but the old approach where people felt a sense of responsibility for those and that we were part of the community and it was all about equality of opportunity, all those things seem to have gone. It's back to Trump's line of basically the strong, you know, only the strong survive and you have no responsibility for the weak. But yeah, of course, I'm certainly much more critical of things now and more questioning. I believed in a lot of these institutions, perhaps revered them, and that's perhaps why I feel so disillusioned with them. If I was cynical about them in the first place, I perhaps wouldn't feel so disappointed now. But I still have faith that, you know, we do need an independent judiciary, we do need an independent civil service, we want policemen who are not politicised. We want people to rise in the army or the Foreign Office, not because they kowtow to the powerful, but because they do their jobs properly. It may be a rather idyllic, naive view, but I still think we can get back there. Those are the sort of values that people respected in Britain. Some of the values of private schools, you know, as long as they were able to have a needs blind way of bringing in the best. I mean, well, grammar schools, very good example. You know, I do believe in elites because you need elites in order to run things. But elites need, as Victorians had for a time and the Greeks, you need to have a sense that you operate for the greater good, not in your own self-interest.
It's funny, you brought up Trump there. I mean, it seems like he's got off scot-free. I mean, all of the kind of legal ramifications, the soul searching seems to be happening in Europe. I mean, in this country, it's destabilized us more than it has done in America. Some people have said that that's a sign that, you know, perhaps our democracy is still functioning the way that it should. You know, this is an issue that needs to create some sort of reckoning. So, I mean, what do you think this is, the ramifications are for the US, especially the transatlantic alliance, right? Like, we have been dependent on the US, not just economically, but also for our own security. And that seems to be undoing at the moment with Trump's, you know, machinations towards Greenland and the NATO alliance.
Yes, the rules-based system is gone. We're back to almost the 18th or 19th century of nation states with alliances and competing interests. Trump, I don't think, is off the hook. I mean, there's plenty of material in there. There's plenty of testimony which he must find embarrassing. And this is stuff that he supposedly, what we call, dry cleaned. And there's plenty of testimony from other people, I suspect, will come forward. So it's about timing. Andrew may have thought that, you know, these are events from 30 years ago that he thought he was fine, and he's been caught. And so I don't think Trump's off the hook. I mean, it's all sometimes a matter of time. But I do think that, he has been, unfortunately, you know, a permanent, his changes will be permanent. I think, you know, it's even if the Democrats, I think, win the next election, many of those alliances and those organizations, the way of seeing the world, have changed, unfortunately. And so the things that did preserve the peace for 60 years, the sort of bipartisan approach to a lot of issues, those things have gone. And it's a dog-eat-dog world and back. And, you know, that can't be good for anyone, whether you're strong or weak.
Yeah, I wonder what you think the UK should do in terms of how it should position itself. I mean, do we just slavishly follow America, or do we think, as a la Mark Carney, about some form of middle powers alliance where we stand side by side with other rule of law democracies?
Well, that's why I talked about alliances. You know, that's what we're moving back towards. And I think Carney's right. I think much of this was triggered by Brexit. That there was, again, a general feeling that we were stronger operating together, that wasn't perfect. But by operating together, we had more influence in the world in all sorts of areas, whether it's economics or politics. And that is gone. A lot of those treaties have been ripped up. But it would just be a whole series of different arrangements.
Yeah, I mean, that point about Brexit in particular is quite striking, right? There was an email from Epstein to Peter Thiel talking about Brexit just happening, calling it just the beginning, and explaining that a whole new world order was on the horizon. I mean, it's pretty kind of, it sends shivers down your spine to read comments like that, you know, seeing how the world has kind of fared ever since. Andrew Lowney, look, I know you've been super busy. Every single person, every journalist in this country wants to talk to you right now. I really appreciate you spending some time with us today at What's Left and giving us your opinion about the Prince Andrew debacle and the Epstein affair. Thank you very much for coming on.
Not at all. Pleasure.